From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bob Woodruff and his wife Lee talk about his difficult but remarkable recovery from the severe brain injury he sustained while reporting from Iraq. A roadside bomb exploded a few yards away from his tank. It was less than a month after Woodruff had become co-anchor of the ABC Nightly News. Bob and Lee Woodruff have collaborated on a new memoir. Also, screenwriter and director Mark Lawrence tells us about his new film Music and Lyrics, starring Hugh Grant as a has-been 80s pop star and Drew Barrymore as the woman he convinces to write lyrics for his melodies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Woodruff is starting to return to journalism. Less than a month after Woodruff became the co-anchor of the ABC Nightly News in January 2006, he almost died in Iraq while on assignment. A band of insurgents detonated a remote-controlled roadside bomb that exploded a few yards from the tank he was in. Woodruff sustained a severe brain injury and was in a coma for over a month. His cameraman, Doug Vogt, was seriously injured too. Woodruff has had a difficult but remarkable recovery. Last night, he was the subject of an ABC News special in which he also reported on soldiers who suffered brain injuries in Iraq. Woodruff and his wife, Lee, have written a new memoir about his injury and the process of recovery, called In an Instant. The chapters alternate between his point of view and hers. Bob Woodruff, Lee Woodruff, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you so much for coming. First, I'd like to just know, Bob, how are you now? How much of a recovery have you made?
Well, I think it's sped up pretty quickly. From the very beginning, it's just much better now. I'd say every day, every week, I get some kind of improvement where I'm able to speak better now than I did 6 months ago and certainly more than 13 months ago.
And physically?
Physically, there's really not a major problem that much anymore. I think part of it was I was in this tank that my lower part of my body was protected when this IED went off, and the brain at the top is getting better too.
And Lee, from your point of view, how far has he progressed in the recovery?
I would say Bob's 95% there. I'm not much of a statistician, but he is, from the beginning, the amazing thing, and the doctors were amazed by this as well, his personality, the very essence of what made him Bob, was completely intact, which really is a miracle with a brain injury because there's so many things that can go awry. But he's built back much of his language and cognitive function, and his writing's come back, and it's been a miracle to watch.
What's your last memory before the explosion?
Well, I have some memories about us driving down the road in Taji before we hit into the IED that exploded. But what I remember from the time of the explosion, I've only really remembered two little things since then. At the moment that I hit, I just really actually went asleep. I was knocked out for a minute. And during that minute, I saw my body floating below me. In kind of a whiteness. And I had that for about a minute. I don't know much more than that, but that's what I saw. And then I woke up and I looked across the tank where Doug Vogt, who's my cameraman, who was also standing up with me above outside of the tank when it exploded, and he was also injured. He had come down back into the tank. And when I woke up, I saw him staring ahead at me with his large eyes afraid and blood coming down the outside of his head. And that's pretty much everything I can remember. Within 10 minutes after that, apparently I was then asleep, and then I was in coma for the next 36 days.
Lee, what was the physical damage to your husband caused by the IED?
Well, I first saw him when we went to Landstuhl to meet him and Doug. And when I walked in the room in the ICU, the nurse brought me around to his good side first. He was hit on the left side of his body, and so the left side of his face and his head was just raked with hundreds of rocks and dirt and cuts. There were stitches, it seemed like, all over his face, the bridge of his nose, through his lips. His eye was completely swollen up. I was sure that he was blind. And his ear was mangled. It was unrecognizable as an ear. But the scariest part for me, not knowing what a traumatic brain injury really was that his brain had swollen out of his head where his skull had been cut off and looked much like a popover or a rugby ball. It was just giant, and there were tubes everywhere coming out of him. It was frightening.
Bob, when you went to Iraq, what did you want to accomplish there? What kind of stories were you hoping to bring back?
Well, what we wanted to see was exactly what the U.S. military was doing in relationship to the Iraq military. They were starting to pass over power to the Iraqis in several parts of the country, and I wanted to see how that was working, how the U.S. military was doing in terms of teaching them of what they needed to do and training other soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, that needed to take over a lot of these operatives. And that's what we were doing up in the Taji area north of Baghdad. And we were, one of the things that was important to me once we discovered what they were doing, that we'd go into an Iraqi tank, one of the vehicles that they were using to travel around with the U.S. military. And that's what I was in when this all hit.
Were you about to do a stand-up report when it hit?
I was in the middle of doing a stand-up when this thing went off. We had actually just completed trying to do a stand-up, but there was so much noise up there that the sound was not working. It was nothing we could ever really use in a piece. And in fact, Doug, who my cameraman, was standing there right in front of me, right next to me. One of the Iraqi drivers said to him, you know, we're coming up to very close trees up here outside the road. This is an area that might be a little bit more dangerous for IED. You guys, maybe you ought to get down in. And we're really just about to do so when this thing exploded. That's all we knew.
Lee, you were describing when you first saw your husband, what he looked like. He was put into a medically induced coma for about a month. Did you see him before he was put into the coma?
Bob was in a coma from the minute that he woke back up and then fell back into whatever state that he was in and never woke up from that moment in time. They kept him medically sedated because when they began to sort of lift the medication, he would get agitated as the weeks wore on. But yet he wasn't waking up. He wasn't following commands. He wasn't able to open his eyes on command or move his feet. And that was becoming very disturbing to them. They very much wanted to lift the medication, but his own brain, his own body needed to be able to have that happen, and it wasn't happening. He wasn't waking up.
And I'll tell you, Terry, how amazing the job was that the military did in this situation, which it does for every soldier and Marine that goes through this over there. First of all, when we got hit, there was a fire of guns going off, and there's a fight that went underway between those who had attacked us with the IED and then started shooting with guns. They got those down. Then they got me out of the tank into another vehicle. From the vehicle, they drove me out to a helicopter. The helicopter then flew down to Baghdad. They looked at me, my condition there, and then they fly me in another helicopter up to Balad, which is north of Baghdad. And that's where they then cut off part of my skull. That was all within 37 minutes of the time the attack happened. That's how fast they got me to the military medical people to help save my life. And it made a big difference in the quality of my brain because they were able to get it cooled down and some of the pressure taken off of it so quickly.
And that's why they removed part of the skull because otherwise the pressure would have been too great from the swelling.
That's right. If you've got someone that's been hit by a massive blast in a place like that, and especially from these IEDs, which are huge numbers of them there now, the best thing to do if you've got a lot of brain that's been shaking up inside, even if it's not cut through in any way, or any rocks that go through the neck and the cheek and everything else, which it did with me, sometimes you need to get that skull off so that the brain can expand and take the pressure off of it.
Lee, when you were visiting Bob in the hospital when he was in the coma, you talk to him a lot. You know, a lot of people believe that somebody in a coma is still capable of registering in some way the presence of a loved one and registering, like, you know, soothing, encouraging language. Did you believe when you were talking to him that you were actually getting through to him?
I knew I was getting through to Bob. I knew it from a lot of different ways. There was a moment when my daughter came in and she played this game with him called the kissing contest, which is something they always did when he was away in foreign places covering stories. And a tear rolled down his eye and we both just started cheering because we knew that he could hear us. And the doctors had this running joke with me because they couldn't get Bob to follow any commands. But yet when I would come in and just talk to him and sort of brush his hair away from his eyes, actually he had no hair, his head was shaven, but just touch his face on his good side, he would calm down. He would visibly calm down, sort of like a spooked colt. And they would say, somewhere deep in his unconscious, he must really, be well trained. And I said to the doctors, couldn't it just be that he loves me so much he's willing to do what I ask? And they sort of shot me a funny look. My favorite story, though, and I'll try to make this quick, my favorite story was a letter that I read to Bob from one of his icons, Bruce Springsteen. A friend had passed a letter on from Bruce, he'd heard that Bob was a fan, and Bruce had sent CDs and a note down, and we constantly played Bruce's music, and music was a big healer for Bob. And so I took the note and read it to him one day, and I aggrandized it a little bit. I kind of changed Bruce's, well, maybe someday, you know, I can play for you, to kind of telling Bob that Bruce was maybe going to come down to the hospital and play for Bob and all of the soldiers. So I didn't think anything of it, and on the second day when Bob woke up from his coma, he looked at me, and he couldn't come up with a lot of words, so he just kind of said, I need one of those, and he began strumming with his hands, pantomiming a strumming of a guitar. And I said, a guitar? And he said, yeah, I got to be ready. I got to be ready when that boss man comes. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he heard me in the coma. So be careful what you say.
So did Springsteen ever come and perform?
No, he hasn't yet. if he's listening, come out.
Bob, did you have any sense at all that somewhere deep down, unconsciously, you knew that your wife was talking to you, that your children were there? Can you tell at all that you experienced anything like that during the coma?
You know, I to this very day, I have no idea, to tell you the truth, Terry. I don't know if I was listening to them or if I could understand them. But certainly when I woke up, I didn't have any kind of memory about it. In fact, I couldn't even remember the names of my brothers. I couldn't remember the names of my children or any states in the country or any countries in the world. I couldn't remember any of the names. It took a long time of rehabilitation for me to get that. But I think the name of Lee I did remember for sure.
Now, did all those names eventually come back to you, or is it that you had to relearn them? Were you taught them over again?
No. I have not had to restudy all of the English language, but some of it has just come back naturally through my brain. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of them, it's helpful if I can have them written down, and so I can see them sometimes in my brain, a word that maybe I can't easily remember. But for the most part, it's just slowly over time been popping back. There's still a lot that I still can't remember.
There's so much, though, Terry, that needs to be done with people like Bob and the soldiers and anyone who's had an accident, because some of it does come back naturally, but a lot of it is through the beginning of the exercising of the brain with cognitive rehab to rebuild those neurons and those connections to those words. The way the doctors described it to me is those words are all in there, those memories are all in there. It's just that the pathways have been sheared off with the blast, and you've got so many brain cells that you don't use. So what you need to do is exercise them, and you have a window of time in which to do that, to reconnect to those words.
But it really depends on where you're hit. Since I was hit in the left side of my head, that is a linguistic kind of area, or my language. If someone gets hit on the right, it's sometimes often more physical about your ability to move your arm, sometimes to see distance out of your eyes. And obviously, having met so many soldiers and Marines that have been injured, and those with traumatic brain injury in this and hit in different places, I can see the different kinds of injuries that they've gotten depending on which side they're hit on.
My guests are Bob and Lee Woodruff. They've collaborated on a memoir called In an Instant. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests is Bob Woodruff and Lee Woodruff, and they've collaborated on a book about their experiences after he was hit on assignment in Iraq shortly after he'd become the anchor for ABC News. The book is called In an Instant. You know, we were talking about you being in a medically induced coma. Do you remember what your first memory was, what your first sense of where you were and what happened to you was when you came out of that coma?
Yeah, well, since I got hit on January 29th, and then it was March
6th.
6th, about 35, 36 days later that I finally woke up. And I remember about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was one of these strange that I still remember. And one of the nurses were inside the room with me, and I woke up, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I looked around, and I recognized that I was alive, and I was in a hospital. And it was 3 hours later, because they didn't tell Lee that I had already woken up. So she showed up, which, like, she had so many day after day after day all that month. She finally came in. Her hair was still wet. She'd come back from swimming. And I saw her walk in, and I said, "Honey, where have you been?" And this was like the miracle that I had woken up, and it couldn't, she couldn't believe it.
Did you have any idea what had happened to you? Did you remember the explosion?
I think at the time I slowly to start remember what it was. I know there was some kind of explosion. I don't know if the tank had crashed or if there was an explosion, but I pretty much know at that moment that it was something, some kind of bomb. IED. But I didn't really know exactly what it was. In fact, Lee, over a number of days and certainly weeks and maybe even months, was very slow about giving me the actual details about what I had been through. But one of the first questions I really wanted to find out was how Doug Vogt was, my cameraman, because he was up there with me. And I wanted to see how he was, and I was told that he had actually come out alive and had not been in a coma. He was, had some surgery as well, but his was getting better a lot through. And I was guilty feeling at that moment, and I just wanted to make sure everybody else was okay.
Lee, why were you so slow in giving Bob the details of what had happened to him?
Well, the doctors were very concerned about post-traumatic stress disorder, which a lot of the soldiers and Marines experience, and they thought that I should be sort of carefully meeting out the details of this. In fact, I think it was hours later that we sort of told Bob that he was missing part of his skull. And I remember his hands sort of feeling around at the top of his head in kind of a sense of wonder. And he did wake up really with this filter off a little bit. He was funny. He was glad to be alive. He was exuberant. And I really do think that when he said, "Honey, where have you been?" he really didn't know a lot about what was going on. He just couldn't figure out why he'd been waiting for me for 3 hours and I hadn't been right there by his bedside. As we gave him the details little by little, he would process them all and ask more questions, and the journalist in him often came out. But I think it was a careful exposure for him to see the magnitude of what had happened and how his world had changed.
Lee, watching Bob's recovery, what were the most frightening parts where you were afraid that things were taking a bad turn?
I think probably the most frightening phase for me was right before he woke up, because he still wasn't waking up. And so the doctors and nurses had begun to talk to me gently about maybe looking at nursing facilities, a place to sort of park Bob, for lack of a better term, until he could wake up more, because they had done all they could do for him in the acute phase at Bethesda. And at that point, I really was envisioning, you know, what would life be like with someone who would be essentially like another child in my house? Here was this husband, this strong man, this person that I depend on, and now I would possibly be changing his diapers or, taking the most fundamental care of him in a way I had never imagined.
How were you resolved to behave if that happened?
You know, Terry, I created this character in my mind that I refer to as the General. And part of what the General did is I was not going to come to grips with anything. I wasn't going to make any decisions or put myself in any shoes as best I could until he woke up. I told myself until he woke up and we knew what we were dealing with, could he speak? That was a huge question, because there was a rock that went all the way through his neck and they couldn't tell what kind of real estate it had hit, esophagus, vocal cords, what have you, nerves of his face. So I kept telling myself, we don't know anything. Don't project. Live in the moment. Truly live hour to hour. And when he wakes up and you know what your deficits are there, then you can begin to freak out.
Bob Woodruff, when you came out of the coma and you tried to start expressing yourself, and there were many times when you couldn't find the words, and there were times when the therapist would hold up picture cards and you had to identify what was the picture and say the word broom or whatever, and you couldn't because the brain wasn't operating well yet. Was it really frustrating? Did you have to deal with a lot of frustration, and how did you manage that?
It was extremely frustrating. There's no question about it. I never thought how long it would go, how long I would have problems, what I eventually learned these kind of words. I mean, I couldn't even say hammer or comb, scissors. Those kinds of words, they couldn't come into my mind. And of course, just imagine how frustrating that is to somebody like you and I, who have, you know, done this professionally for so long. I mean, just imagine it as well for some 18 or 19-year-old injured, traumatic brain injury kind of soldier or Marine that's had to go through the same thing, of just how frustrating it would be even to them. And it absolutely was.
Can you just give a sense of when you would, like, take stock of your life and what you were facing, what the balance was between depression and feeling sorry for yourself and feeling lucky to be alive?
I think I got so much of the latter, which is feeling lucky about what had happened and how it worked out. There was time, certainly, of a lot of sadness about what had happened. Not so much, I have to say, my thoughts were not so much about what happened to me. It's what had happened to my family and what happened to my wife and my children. And I was especially worried about my children because they're so young and they don't really understand what could be happening and what will be happening. And that, to me, filled me also with a great deal, not only of frustration, but guilt.
Bob and Lee Woodruff will be back in the second half of the show. Their new memoir is called In an Instant. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Bob and Lee Woodruff, and we talk with screenwriter and director Mark Lawrence about his new comedy, Music and Lyrics, starring Hugh Grant as a washed-up 80s pop star trying to write a new song. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bob and Lee Woodruff. Their new memoir is about the process of recovery from the severe brain injury he sustained while reporting in Iraq after a roadside bomb detonated a few yards from his tank. It was in January 2006, less than a month after he had become the co-anchor of the ABC Nightly News. Bob and Lee Woodruff have collaborated on a memoir called In an Instant. Bob, what's it been like for you to read the Washington Post report about Building 18 in Walter Reed Army Hospital and the problems it had with mold and rats and roaches?
Well, you know, you've got a hospital there. It's going to be, you know, closing down within, you know, what, about 10 years? And obviously it's not being built ahead. One of the things that we all have to understand about this war is that it has changed so quickly compared to what everyone thought in the beginning in terms of how many injured would be coming back. So in that sense, so many of these groups are actually overwhelmed by the kind of growth of it all. Walter Reed certainly is one. Well, they've got wonderful doctors and nurses that are working in these ICU kind of situations. And then later on, as things go down the years with rehabilitation, it's also really hard to catch up. And so there's some situations like that where it's happening. For me, I've seen a lot of it in the VA. The VA in the smaller parts of the country, in the smaller towns, they just don't have the knowledge and the experience with helping those with traumatic brain injuries. And there may be significant numbers of those. We could have as many as 10% of all those that have served in this wars of the Iraq and Afghanistan, which could be out of 1.5 million people, maybe 150,000 that have some kind of TBI. And so you're seeing that in a place like that right in Washington, D.C., where there are some people running behind, even though there's a lot of people working even harder than they did before. But you just got to catch up, and you've got to start looking at it, and you have to have people in the country to know about it so that they can step up their own donations to these kinds of things and to help more people in the situation trying to help to save some of these soldiers and Marines.
Was most of your recovery in Army hospitals?
You know, 5 weeks of his recovery was at Bethesda Naval. And then when he woke up, we were able to take him home up to New York, to Manhattan,
right,
where he was an inpatient for about 3 weeks, where he again beat their estimations. They had sort of estimated it would be a 6 to 8 week time period as an inpatient. And then after 3 weeks, he came home, which was terrifying at first to me. And he was going every day on an outpatient basis to Mount Sinai Hospital, where he did and still does his rehabilitation.
You know, in so many ways, we've been lucky. Since the military treated me like I was a military person that was injured in this situation, and as I described, the kind of speed that they used to save my life was exactly what they would do with so many of the other soldiers and Marines that get in the same situation. I was not treated at all differently. And then once I got out and went out for longer term of rehabilitation, I was able to have my own choice as well about what to do. And we, of course, came some closer to our house and went to a private group, the Sinai Hospital, up in New York to work through my rehabilitation as I went on. Not everybody has that choice necessarily. Some of them do have the ability to get into a private kind of resource. But it's something that we certainly had advantage for, and it's helped me, I think, a lot. Also, just coming back to the job that I've got now and doing journalism again has really helped me mentally.
Lee, you describe how when you were spending so much time at the hospital, your children were starting to get kind of, you know, like glum and resentful because you weren't with them as much as they were used to. How did you deal with that in trying to explain to them why you had to be in the hospital?
Well, we have four children, and the older two understood. It was the twin 5-year-old girls who really had a hard time with why was mommy gone and why were there so many friends there all the time. They knew daddy was sick, but a wise doctor who actually put Bob's skull back on, Dr. Costantino, said to me, he does a lot of skull-based tumors and a lot of tumors. He said, you know, things begin to fall apart at the 5-week mark with families, and he's seen it time and time again. When someone comes to his offices in New York for surgery from Kansas or somewhere in the West Coast, and they're living apart from the family, the 5-week mark, for some reason, is where it hits. And that was very true with my kids. I felt like the center was holding at first. And then really as we crossed the threshold of 5 weeks of Bob still being in the coma, which is ironically right about when he woke up, I felt like I just simply couldn't do it anymore. The kids, the balance of scales had tipped a bit, and the kids were needing me more than Bob. And I felt completely split in two because I didn't know what we were going to do.
But that's when things changed in the hospital.
You know what, Terry? I went to bed the Sunday night before he woke up, and he woke up on a Monday morning, and I had put the children in a van to go to the airport and fly back up to New York with my sister and brother-in-law. And I was sobbing back at the hotel into Bob's brother Dave's arms. And I just said, David, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I don't know how much longer I can live away from my children. And Bob just has to wake up. He has to take it from here. I can't do anymore. I can't stand over his bed and talk to him anymore. I'm hoarse. I can't come up with any more stories. What is this family going to do? And sure enough, when I walked in that next morning, that was when he was sitting up in bed, eyes bright as two little coals, big smile on his goofy face with his shaved head and his sunken brain. And he said, you know, sweetie, where have you been? And I just thought, oh, my gosh, he heard me. He heard my prayers. I can't even believe this.
And you know that period when his memory was not quite back yet and he didn't remember words and names of places or things that had happened to him? Lee, this could be an odd opportunity to put your spin on his past, you know, to reacquaint him with his past, but your version of the stories.
And don't think I didn't think about it, Terry. Yes. I said, oh, you remember me, the most loving and wonderful wife ever. Well, you know, we laughed a lot about that. And one of the things we laughed about, and one of the great Bob Woodruffisms, which we had many of, is he woke up and he was sort of bored, as he said. He couldn't really focus on books too much, and the TV was okay, but that would get boring after a while. And we both really lived like trapped specimens in a house, because without part of his skull, you can't really go gallivanting around outside. And it was dangerous, and he had to wear a white plastic helmet at all times. And that's sort of an attention getter. So we were very much homebodies, and Bob ultimately found himself cleaning up the kitchen, which I can tell you in almost 19 years of marriage was something that just about knocked my socks off, literally. So he would be prissing around the house and sponging things up, and he looked at me one day and he said, I am really anus now. And I said, I think you mean anal, honey, but I like that. So we're all a little bit anus.
Thank you so much, Bob Woodruff, Lee Woodruff, for talking with us, and good luck to you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Bob and Lee Woodruff's new memoir is called In an Instant. Coming up, we talk with Mark Lawrence about writing and directing the new comedy Music and Lyrics, starring Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore. This is Fresh Air. My guest Mark Lawrence wrote and directed the new movie Music and Lyrics. It's filled with in-jokes about 80s pop. The film stars Hugh Grant as a washed-up 80s pop star who's reduced to performing at amusement parks. And then an opportunity comes his way. A Britney Spears-type teen star, who was his fan as a child, asks him to write a song for her. If she likes it, she'll record it and debut it in a duet with him. He's good at writing melodies, but he doesn't write lyrics. In the process of searching for a lyricist, he realizes the woman who just started taking care of his plants seems to have a way with words, so he recruits her to collaborate on the song. She's played by Drew Barrymore. Several of the songs in the film were written by Adam Schlesinger of the band Fountains of Wayne. In this scene from Music and Lyrics, Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore are in his apartment trying to write the song.
And I don't think those chords are right. It has to sound different than the verse.
What kind of different did you have in mind?
I don't know, something sadder, you know? And I still don't like my line about places in my mind.
It's fine.
Fine isn't good.
Well, you only have time for fine. I tell you what, look, you will change your line about places in my mind if I can keep the chord sequence into the bridge, yeah?
This isn't a negotiation. It's either right or wrong, inspired or insipid.
I tell you what it is, it's 4 a.m. and we're not writing the last movement of the Jupiter Symphony. It's a song for someone whose last hit was called Welcome to Booty Town. Please get back to work.
Still don't like it.
Whoa.
And it's entering Booty
right.
Town.
Mark Lawrence, welcome to Fresh Air. What was the start of this idea? Like, what idea did the movie start with?
Well, Hugh Grant and I had worked together on a previous film, and we had a great time together. So we were trying to come up with something else to do, and I'm a failed musician. I play a lot of instruments badly, and I'm obsessed with music. I'm obsessed with songwriting. And so things just sort of took a natural course in that direction. What would I write about songwriting? How could I get music to be an integral part of a film? And then the idea of a songwriter and combining that with Hugh, and given Hugh's age, when would he have been a songwriter? And then the idea that he would have been a performer-songwriter immediately made it more visual and more interesting and maybe a little bit less cerebral in a good way. So that was the genesis of the thing.
So the whole idea of it being about a washed-up 80s guy who'd been in a hit band was because of Hugh Grant's age, not because of your particular interest in 80s bands?
Unfortunately, that's true. I wish I could tell you that I was obsessed with Wham or Duran Duran. The truth is, during the 80s, I was much more likely to be listening to Elvis Costello or The Clash or The Ramones or The Beatles or The Stones or Talking Heads. I was aware of all those other bands. They were kind of inescapable. But truthfully, I didn't take them particularly seriously, and nor was I a big fan. When we began doing this film and I went back to do research, which included looking at a lot of those videos and listening to a lot of that music that I hadn't, that's when I really started to develop an affection for it, because once you remove the cheesy sound effects and production effects and if you're watching the video, you can, by the fifth or sixth time you're looking at it, you can sort of ignore the tight pants and the insane hair. There was a lot of good music. Uh-huh. And so I enjoy it more now than I did when I started the project.
Well, there's a song called Pop Goes My Heart that Hugh Grant's band in the movie Pop records. And that's their big hit from the 80s, mm-hmm. Pop Goes My Heart. So you had to get somebody to, write this song. So who did you choose for Pop Goes My Heart?
Pop Goes My Heart was written by Andrew Wyatt and Alana Vincente, I believe is the pronunciation of her last name. And Andrew is just a brilliantly talented songwriter and musician. And Andrew wrote not only Pop Goes My Heart, but pretty much all of these songs for the Britney Spears-type character in the film. And Andrew actually has quite a bit of experience writing for and producing songs for Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and that group of people.
Well, let's play the song, and then I'll ask you to describe what the video is like. So here's Pop Goes My Heart from the soundtrack of Music and Lyrics. Okay, so we just heard the song that was written for the 80s band in Music and Lyrics, in which Hugh Grant plays a songwriter. And there's a great video. My guest Mark Lawrence directed the movie. And Mark, there's a great video that opens the movie.
Right.
It's a great 80s video for this song. So I imagine you conceived and shot the video yourself.
I did. Once Andrew had written the song, I used that as the kickoff point for how we were going to construct the video, and I went back and watched a lot of those 80s videos, and a lot of them had performance aspects to them. You see the band playing and jumping around, and then a lot of them also had acting, if you can call it that, storylines to them, which were always just unbelievably over the top, with everyone over-emoting and shaking their heads and just a great theater of bad acting. And so I thought it would be nice to combine those two. So I came up with that little storyline working off of the lyrics, where Hugh's heart is broken because his his girl has left him, and it's so broken that he winds up in the hospital, and then he has a dream about the girl who left him, and then the sexy nurse who revives him reinstills his faith in love, and he bounces back off the gurney, and it's, you know, it's taken from a Chekhov short story, and
and needless to say, there's lots of quick edits, and there's a like black and white checkerboard background through a lot of it. So what videos did you study for this, and what were certain things where you thought, like, I've got to do my version of that?
Well, Terry, I guess I can let you in on this secret, which is if anyone goes and decides to watch the Wham video, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, you will certainly notice some similarities. That if there was a template for it, that was it. And partially because the idea for Hugh's story mirrored to me kind of a George Michael, Andrew Ridgely story where there were two guys in a band and one went on to become a household name and a huge star and the other one was more likely to be the subject of a Where Are They Now show. So that led us to Wham. And then the feeling of the band of pop, I thought, should be closer to a teeny bopper, sort of a Beatles in the Mop Top era, rather than anything darker. So I watched all the Wham videos. I watched a bunch of the Duran Duran videos and Flock of Seagulls.
Well, I want to get back to the soundtrack, to music and lyrics. And one of the songs on here was actually written by your 13-year-old son. How did that happen?
Well, we paid him, so he was happy to do it. And it's hard because you're always going to sound like my grandparents talking about their kids. Everyone's kid is the greatest, but Clyde is he's the musician I always wanted to be. And by the time he was four and a half, he was playing some fairly mean piano. And my dad, who was a professional musician for many years, I remember when Clyde was four, we heard some of Beethoven's Ninth coming from the piano upstairs in my parents' house, and we both looked at each other and went up there, and there was this tiny little kid sitting there playing it by ear with both hands, and said, "Clyde, where'd you learn to do that?" And he said, "Well, I heard it." And he said, "I can also do it in this key." And then he started transposing. And my father and I just immediately began crying, knowing after generations of failed musicians, we finally had a real one. Because my mom was a singer and my aunt was an opera singer, so there was a lot of music, and I had played in bands for a long time. And he writes a lot of songs, and he writes terrific songs. And as I said, he'd written the theme song for Miss Congeniality when he was seven, and I needed a ballad for this particular spot in the film. And he had already written this song, and I thought, I don't know if he'd finished it, but I thought it would be a good candidate for the movie. And so I asked him to finish it, and he went into his room, and he, you know, has the whole Pro Tools set up and, you know, produced a demo version of it. So that became the song in the movie, and that is Clyde playing piano on it.
My guest is Mark Lawrence. He wrote and directed the new film Music and Lyrics. Here's some of the song his son wrote. Hugh Grant is singing.
It's been so long since I've known right from wrong. Got no job. Sometimes I just sit down and sob, wondering if anything will go right. Oh, will you dance with me tonight?
We'll talk more with Mark Lawrence after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Lawrence. He wrote and directed the new film Music and Lyrics, which stars Hugh Grant as an 80s has-been pop star who is writing a new song and who kind of recruits as his lyricist his the woman who's taking care of his plants, who's played by Drew Barrymore. The dialogue in Music and Lyrics is really funny. Lots of witty retorts and caustic asides from Hugh Grant. You're obviously good at writing this kind of humor. Can you draw on this in real life? Like, can you quip in real life?
Well, I try to do this with my wife, but it requires me writing the setups for her, and she's often not amenable to that. If she'll do the right setup, I can be phenomenally witty. Yeah, I can. You know, the first thing that I did professionally was writing on a sitcom, and it was called Family Ties. And when I showed up there, and this was shot out in L.A., I was 24 years old, and I had just dropped out of law school. And I'd never written with anyone else. I had just written a few scripts and was lucky enough to have them like it and fly me out there. And suddenly I was sitting at a table in L.A. at Paramount Studios with five other really talented, really clever, really smart writers. And my first day there, you know, we would all sit around a table together and work on the script, which involved taking the script that we had on the stage that week and improving it. And I sat there, and people were so fast and so funny and so quick. And I remember calling Linda, was not my wife yet, but we were already going out, and calling her and saying, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. It's just too fast. And but you know, I stayed on the show, and they were nice enough to keep me on the show. And very quickly, I sort of got into that rhythm, and it became one of my favorite things to do. And TV training, and I was at that show writing and producing it for 5 years. And that kind of training is really, really invaluable, I think, when you're doing a comedy.
Now, you got started in your writing career writing for Family Ties, and that happened because you sent them a spec script. What was right. That script that you sent?
I had, actually, the first script I wrote was called The World's Most Famous House, and it was based on my experiences at college, living in an off-campus house with some people. And I sent that script out. I got a book called The Writer's Market, which I believe is still published now, and it listed all the agents that you could send a script to, all the WGA-approved agents. And, you know, I typed my script and I copied it. This was sort of before computer. This was 1983, I guess. I didn't have a computer. And I put them, I guess, about 50 or 60 of them in envelopes and sent them out to pretty much every agent in that book. And they all came back, not even rejected, just unread, except for two. One of them was from a lady named Marcia Amsterdam, who is still lives here in Manhattan, and she was a literary agent, mostly concentrating on books, and she said, you know, I read this and I like it, come on up and talk, and she became my first agent. And she said, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd like to write for movies and television. She said, let's start with TV because the scripts are shorter and it's faster. And I had not watched television in quite a while at college or whatever sitcoms were on. So I got a copy of TV Guide and I circled all the sitcoms that were on that year. And I, on a little black and white television, I started watching them. And the two that struck me were Cheers and Family Ties. And I particularly was attracted to the character that Michael Fox was playing on Family Ties. So I went and wrote a script. And she sent it out, and they called, and they flew me out. And then suddenly I was there. And the only other script that was read of those 50 or 60 that I sent out was by a man named Jack Rollins, who, of course, was Woody Allen's producer. Not just Woody Allen, but, you know, Billy Crystal and David Letterman. He said, come on up, I want to talk to you. And I went up to his office on 57th Street, sat in this room surrounded by these huge pictures of Woody Allen. Just I had run out from the job I was in at the time on my lunch hour. And he walked in carrying two pastrami sandwiches, and he said, one of these is for you. And he sat down, and we just started talking. We must have talked for two and a half hours. And it was everything you wanted show business to be. This was a man who just loved comedy writing because he loved it. And he answered all my questions about Woody Allen and about comedy writing. And at the end of it, he said, take a look at this script. I think this is the kind of movie that you could write. And it was a movie that he had just produced, and it was called Arthur. And it was the first screenplay I had ever seen in my life. And I took that and ran out of the office, and it was probably still the most thrilling meeting I ever had in show business. So those were the two people who responded to the script.
Mark Lawrence, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Mark Lawrence wrote and directed the new film Music and Lyrics. If you want to catch something you missed on our show, Fresh Air is now available as a podcast on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another scene from the soundtrack of Music and Lyrics featuring Drew Barrymore and Hugh Grant.
Way back into love? Take one.
I'm getting really nervous.
You'll be fine. You just use your normal, nice voice that I've heard so much of in the last 3 days.
It's like, my throat's closing up. It's like anaphylactic.
It's fine. It's just a 3-minute song.
I've been living with a shadow overhead. I've been sleeping with...
Just a little bit louder, because this song is intended for humans, okay? Way back into love, take two.
Been living with a shadow overhead. I've been sleeping with a cloud above my bed. I've been lonely for so long. Trapped in the past, I just can't seem to move on.
I've been hiding all my hopes and dreams away, just in case I ever need them again someday. I've been setting aside time to clear a little space in the corners of my mind. All I wanna do is find a way back into love. I can't make it through without a...
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Adopted Son, A Story of Washington, Lafayette, and the Friendship That Saved the Revolution by David A. Clary. From Kay and Matthew Buxbaum, whose Buxbaum International Fellowship trains journalists for reporting from all over the world. Details are at npr.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, connecting social entrepreneurs around the world with an online community called Social Edge. Learn more at socialedge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The battle in Sadr City in April 2004 was a turning point in the war in Iraq when American troops realized they were facing an insurgency. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with ABC White House correspondent Martha Raddatz about her new book, which reconstructs the battle. She's been to Iraq 12 times since the American invasion. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.